The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A look back at a crucial battle in World War II on today's program. Also a brief excerpt from an interview with a writer of historical fiction inspired primarily by the Civil War. By the way, on Monday's Morning Show, I'll be speaking with a Carthage professor of astronomy about the total eclipse that much of the country is going to be able to witness on Monday. And next week, we'll also include a look back at 9/11 and also two conversations with people who live in Charlottesville, Virginia. The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. This portion of WGTD's Morning Show is spent examining a critical turning point in the Second World War. The book at hand is Midnight in the Pacific, Guadalcanal, the World War II battle that turned the tide of war. In many respects, this was America's first great offensive attempt in the Second World War. And in some respects, it did not come when it was expected. At the early outset of the war, there was a sense of Europe first, and that America had to be very careful about just when and how it would go after their enemies in the Pacific theater. And then various events conspired to make it necessary for Allied forces to take the offensive in the Pacific as well. And in some respects, in a place that before the onset of the war would have seemed quite unremarkable and a very unlikely place for such a crucial battle to occur, Guadalcanal. And the author of this book, Joseph Whelan, has done a superb job of setting the stage for this crucial, critical moment in the Second World War and the battle that ensued over the course of months. Joseph Whelan has a number of books to his credit, including Terrible Swift Sword and Jefferson's War. He was a highly admired reporter for the Associated Press for nearly a quarter century. Again, this newest book from his pen is Midnight in the Pacific, Guadalcanal, the World War II battle that turned the tide of war, published by Da Capo Press. And Joseph Whelan, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm really pleased that I can speak with you. I wonder if you could say a word about this book, which is written to coincide with the 75th anniversary of the Marine landing in 1942 that sets most of these events up. What is involved in a historian looking back at a battle from that long ago, and a battle which has been written about and discussed to a great extent? Were you trying to do something here that has not been done before, or to do it more thoroughly, or through the use of sources not accessed before. What is the most important catalyst for you wanting to tell this story now?
Well, I always had a great deal of admiration for the 1st Marine Division, which did this. My father was a member of the division, not at Guadalcanal, but later in the war and in the first year of the Korean War. So I grew up seeing that shoulder patch with the Big One and Guadalcanal lettered down the one. And I'd always wanted to do something on World War II, especially on Guadalcanal. And I didn't think that much was known about it today, actually, because it became overshadowed by other battles such as Tarawa, Iwo Jima especially, in the Pacific and the Philippines. So I wanted to focus on that. Now, so as far as pulling a book together on this, my purpose was to provide, I guess, some fresh perspectives on it and to write it in a way that would appeal to average readers. And I did that by first learning the reading extensively and getting a general outline of what the campaign consisted of. And it was air, land, and sea campaign, so rather complex. And then going to repositories such as the Navy Library, the Marine Corps Historical Society, the Army's archive in Pennsylvania, and getting oral history presentations made by people who had fought there. And these were recorded and transcribed as long as 40 years ago, back in the 70s, some of them even in the 60s when their memories were fresh. So I was able to get a lot of good stuff that way.
One thing that I found striking in your book is how well you share with us the perspective of the Japanese, of, in a sense, the enemy. They were certainly the enemy then, if now they are a friend to the United States, but a bitter foe in the Second World War. And I didn't notice in the acknowledgments any mention of specific connections that you made with resources kind of on the Japanese side. But my sense in reading your book is that you share this story with a very clear sense of the Japanese perspective and approach and reaction to various events. Can you just say a word about sharing that voice, that side of this story, as vividly as you did, and how you managed to do that so well?
Yeah, that's a good point. Interestingly, the Japanese, many of the soldiers and leaders in that campaign kept diaries, and they wrote letters, and they kept journals. The Americans, and I don't think many people know this, were forbidden to keep diaries. So that was no help. But for the Japanese, that was an amazing source of information. And often by enlisted men who were suffering through some of these campaigns and starving in the jungle. So it filled in a lot of the cracks about, on the other side, what that was like. Also, the Japanese pilots, some of them kept journals, including the famous ace, Saburo Sakai, who had shot down 61 planes before Guadalcanal. Naval people, too. The destroyer captain, Tanaka. Yamamoto kept a journal. So did his chief of staff. So the... pulling all these together, you got a really good picture of what they were doing, how they perceived what was happening on Guadalcanal. Very interesting.
This battle, which at least began under the official moniker of Operation Watchtower, in a sense, as I touched on in the introduction, was a shift in American strategy and a shift away from what was kind of the prevailing, what you call the prevailing Washington orthodoxy of Europe first, the idea that any significant offensive in the Pacific was going to have to wait until 1943. I wonder if you could just say a word about this reality and then why one Ernest J. King, the U.S. Fleet Commander-in-Chief, was so adamantly insistent that we could not wait.
Well, this was a reality, Europe first. England was under siege. Our allies in Europe were living under Nazi dominion, and there was a lot of pressure for us to begin a campaign in Europe to push back the German army. And in fact, we had a our first offensive was supposed to be it's called Operation Torch, which was the landings in North Africa, and that was in November of 42. So yes, this was quite a change, and Ernest King pushed for the campaign on Guadalcanal, and the reason was because the Japanese had seized this island across the channel from Guadalcanal called Tulagi and based seaplanes there. And U.S. officials feared they could disrupt the sea lanes connecting Australia with the United States, because Japan's strategy at that time was to isolate Australia. And then a week after the naval commander for South Pacific met with the 1st Marine Division commander and broke the news to him that you were going to have to land your division in 5 weeks at Tulagi. A week after that meeting, intelligence informed him that the Japanese were also building an airstrip on Guadalcanal, and they were pretty far along on it. So the campaign was expanded to Guadalcanal, too, but they pushed it back a week until August 7th. So it was a real scramble to pull this together in such a short period, as you can imagine.
As a matter of fact, you tell us that among many of the American soldiers, this became known sort of privately to them as Operation Shoestring. And it's interesting because many of the stories that we remember best from this war are stories of immaculate planning and masterful execution, and this is really not such a story. This is much more a story of chaos and improvisation, and a victory that is earned in a way that is. That is, in a sense, quite amazing and surprising. Is that safe to say?
Yes, very safe to say that. All the planning that had been done by the United States had gone into Operation Torch. And all the resources, everything was being meticulously planned. It had been for months. And, yes, this operation on Guadalcanal was just thrown together. And it was improvised. There weren't even any decent maps of Guadalcanal. A lot of people had never heard of it. It was obscure. It was remote. There were probably 10,000 natives who lived there in villages, dense jungle, mountains, rose to 5,000 feet or so. There were no maps. So they had to start from scratch. And during the initial phases of the planning, the Marine Corps was relying on a National Geographic map of the South Pacific to for its planning, and Guadalcanal was shown on the map as being about half an inch long. So it was really thrown together. Only two of the 1st Marine Division's three infantry regiments were available, so they had to pull in other units from all across the Pacific. Amazingly, it all came together, though.
It really did, although it's interesting some of the slight missteps. In fact, I think it'd be interesting if you described what's a really bewildering moment from very, very early in the operation when essentially nothing in the way of a battle has even yet occurred. You described this as an epic traffic jam that developed at Beach Red, where all kinds of supplies were being dropped off, essentially to sustain this operation. Describe this traffic jam that you talk about, and it's sort of what it says about the way this all took shape, at least in the early going.
Yes, they were unloading supplies on Beach Red. So the Navy was bringing them in on landing craft and all sorts of craft. They were the Marine supplies for the coming months. But the problem was the Marines had been told not to help unload the boats. They were expected to defend the beachhead. They were supposed to be ready for an enormous Japanese counterattack, which never came. And they thought that this was the Navy's job. The Navy thought that this was the Marines' job. So the unloading went very slowly, and boats were just backed up all the way back from the beach, trying to get in there. And eventually they expanded the beach landing area so that more craft could land. But it remained a problem for a couple of days, for as long as the Navy was there.
In the very next section of that same chapter, you talk about something that may have blunted the effectiveness of Japan's response to our unexpected move in these early stages of Operation Watchtower, when you talk about the lack of communication between the Army and Navy, that is Japan's Army and Navy. Can you say a word about that? Because I think it's really an interesting detail I don't remember hearing about before. And it kind of flies in the face of what we sometimes assume to have been the almost sort of superhuman cold efficiency of Japanese forces. It's moments like this that underscore just how human and fallible they were.
The Army and Navy pretty much operated in their own silos, you know, and they did not communicate at all as they should have. The Army had pushed this war from the very beginning, and the Navy had always had reservations about everything, including Pearl Harbor. And so, anyway, the Navy had begun building the airstrip on Guadalcanal. The Army didn't even know about it until we landed. They had no idea there was an airstrip, and by then it was nearly built. So this miscommunication continued throughout the campaign. They clashed over how to get troops to the island. The Navy had their ideas. They wanted to land them by destroyers at night, but the destroyers didn't carry that many of them. The Army wanted to land them in these big troop transports, which were just sitting ducks out there in the water in the slot. So they continued to the clash throughout the entire campaign. But the campaign ended with a marvel of efficiency and cooperation between the two when the Navy was able, under the noses of the Americans, to evacuate 11,000 troops over 3 nights off of the island when they decided to withdraw.
So in a sense, they learned how to communicate and cooperate with one another in a way that had not been evident early on. I think another picture you paint here is of the Japanese at the outset being supremely confident, to the point of perhaps being confident in error. I think at one point you say something to the effect that the Japanese were completely certain that they could, I think you, the way you put it is that the Japanese leaders were supremely confident they could fend off pinpricks such as this. The pinpricks referring to these small little American efforts, having no idea just the scale of what America intended to do here.
Well, that's true. The army believed that with their samurai tradition, their ethic of Bushido, they could defeat any enemy, no matter what their numbers, no matter how much firepower they had. And they had been reinforced in this belief during their campaigns in China against the Chinese troops. So they just slaughtered in great profusion. But they really did not understand that firepower and numbers could make a difference.
I'm speaking with Joseph Whelan, the author of Midnight in the Pacific, Guadalcanal, the World War II Battle That Turned the Tide of the War. I would love to have you say a word about something intriguing you say about once the Americans sort of made their move into Guadalcanal. You say that when those first Marines secured that Guadalcanal airfield that the Japanese were constructing but that had not quite finished, that those Marines then needed to become acclimated to this new environment and to acquire and polish their combat skills. Tell us what you mean by that. What was very important for the Marines to do at this point in terms of acclimating themselves to a place like Guadalcanal? And what is this matter of new combat skills that they needed to acquire and perfect?
Well, they were fighting an enemy that was skilled in fighting in the jungle. So they had to learn how to patrol and not get killed. And this took a while for them to learn that. And, for example, one thing they had to learn was in a patrol, you always had the last man would always look behind, because the Japanese had a trick where they would let a patrol pass, and then they would pop up out of the ground. They would have a little hole there and then spray the column, if they could, from behind. So they learned, for example, you had to have a man who would protect the rear. He was their rear guard and would kill the soldier who tried to do that. They had to get used to the rations were terrible. The Navy had left with half of the Marine supplies aboard their transports. And so they were eating basically rice and fish that were stored in warehouses on the island by the Japanese. Two meals a day, they were rationed. And going on these strenuous patrols in 95-degree heat in the jungle with the humidity and the rains would rot off their socks within a week or two. And the humidity, it was just a brutal environment. They contracted malaria, dysentery, and all sorts of other things. Everybody lost weight.
And you tell us that even just the matter of the sounds they heard at night could be really terrifying. new, unknown, unseen terrors that were part of this environment that surrounded them. I think it's really interesting, too. You take the time to chronicle what the Americans found when they took over this airbase at Guadalcanal that the Japanese were constructing, and again, that they did not manage to finish. The Japanese left behind an enormous amount of material and resources, and one has a sense of, just by what they left behind, were forced to leave behind, just what a major operation this airstrip potentially would have been. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about what was left behind by the Japanese and the astonishment of the Americans as they took possession of this?
Oh, they had heavy earth movers, bulldozers. They had front end loaders. They even had a little train. They'd built tracks for it to move the dirt out of the area when they excavated it. And these small cars that they would load the dirt into it. And the Marines called it the Toonerville Express. Toonerville trolley, I believe it was. They had shovels, picks. They had all the stuff that the Marines had it all on their ships, and so they had no access to that. Fortunately, the Japanese did. A lot of heavy earth moving equipment. They were able to. They only had to complete, I believe, 200 yards of the airstrip before it became operational. And within a week, it was finished, and they could begin landing planes there. And this was a huge deal because the Navy had left. The aircraft carriers were gone. There was no air protection. The amphibious force then was forced to leave because they had no air cover. So it was the Marines and the against whatever troops the Japanese could land. There's nothing to stop them, really. And constant air attacks, naval bombardments. So when they finally got this miniature air force in there, there were 31 planes initially. They called it the Cactus Air Force because that was the code name at that time for Guadalcanal. And it became their shield against the daily air attacks. Mm. They could attack ships coming down the slot through the Solomon Islands, too.
As you describe the execution of this Operation Watchtower over the course of 45 days, you tell us it was remarkable that Watchtower got off the ground at all because the two men who divided command of the South Pacific between them both viewed the offensive with grave reservations. We're talking about Vice Admiral Robert Lee Gormley and General Douglas MacArthur. What were their reservations?
They didn't think it would ever work. They thought there was no time. And plus, MacArthur, of course, wanted to put all of the resources into his campaign in New Guinea. That was part of the problem. Gormley was a very cautious admiral, and he didn't think there were enough resources to get it done. He wanted to build up a force and plan it in a more traditional way, like a big amphibious landing, like Operation Torch. So they were against it, and they met, and they agreed that this was a bad idea, and they sent a message to the Joint Chiefs of Staff about this. But Admiral King, the Chief of Naval Operations, had already pushed through the operation, so it was their protests were ignored.
Mm. Well, ultimately, this initial effort is, for the most part at least, successful. But what ensues, of course, is an intense battle that lasts for months. And this is, of course, the heart and soul of your book, which we will leave to our listeners to explore on their own. There's just a couple of important points that I think are worth talking about in terms of what ensued in the battles on and off of Guadalcanal. One of the things that was astonishing, you say, about the way all of this unfolded was that more Japanese planes were shot down than American planes, a fact that is remarkable, you tell us, because of the inferiority of our planes compared to the Japanese Zeros. What was such a difference between American and Japanese planes at this point, and how were we able to achieve such success despite that technical or technological inferiority?
The Japanese Zero was the best fighter plane in the Pacific, 1942, by far. And the main fighter plane deployed by the Navy and Marines was the F-4F Wildcat. And it was inferior, and the pilots knew it. The Japanese Zero was a little bit faster, but it could climb at twice the rate of the Wildcat. It had very little armor on it, and that's why it could. The Wildcat had more armor on it and could take a lot of damage before it was shot down. But initially, when they went into combat against the Zeros, the pilots were warned. They said, if you find yourself one-on-one with the Zero, you should head for home. Don't take them on. However, a Navy pilot named Thatch, he was a squadron commander, came up with a way to counter the Zero. And the way he did is he broke up his squadron into two pilot increments, two planes partnered together. So one of them, when they encountered a Zero, he would start to weave. And by time, the other plane would maneuver and come around and try to get a good shot at the Japanese Zero, either a side shot or a frontal shot. If you hit them with gunfire, they would very often just explode or burst into flames. So this became standard operating procedure. Became known as the Thatch Weave, and I think he got a Navy Cross for coming up with this later in the war.
It's interesting, one of the Japanese commanders, Tanaka, who has a lot to say about this conflict, said that the fatal flaw in Japan's carrying out of its defense of Guadalcanal was the way in which it responded to these American attacks in kind of a piecemeal fashion. Can you explain what he's getting at there? What did the Japanese do wrong in this respect?
Well, they certainly had the advantage, the naval advantage, from the very beginning in August until mid-October. There was a window there. If they could have used their combined fleet all at once, they might have won it against what we were putting out there. And the same with reinforcing the troops on the island. They came in small groups, 1,000 here, 2,000 there. And they would build up and then go on the offensive. And the planes, too, they held back. They would send squadrons out, but not all of them, ever. They had that window there, a two-month window, and Tanaka saw that. And they did not take advantage of it. And as a result, they gave us time to build up our air strength and to get our Navy finally back under a new commander, William Halsey, to fight their Navy and more reinforcements came in as we were able to achieve parity in the air and on the sea. So we were able to counter their offensives on land. But they had a chance about 2 months there. If they would have thrown everything they had in the South Pacific into this, they might have tipped it the other way.
You suggest at one point that the Japanese lacked good intelligence about American forces, and the little intelligence that they had often did not lead to much adjustment of their tactics and strategies. You also tell us that they were consistently underestimating our own strength of will, believing that they were the superior soldiers who could outlast the Americans in any protracted conflict. And that, of course, proved not to be the case.
Yes, that's true. Their intelligence was poor. Initially, they thought we landed maybe 4,000 troops on the island and that we could be just crushed in a real short period. They didn't realize we had 19,000 Marines in that area. They did not know that. They were unable to get good on-time intelligence from the natives because the natives hated them. Wherever the Japanese went in Asia, they alienated the native populations just the way they treated them. And so the Americans had the Melanesians, they were on their side, and they were feeding them intelligence all the time about where the Japanese were, how many. They were quite good. And then finally, the Japanese had contempt for the American soldier, too. They said the Americans did not like to fight at night, they didn't like to fight in the rain, and that they were weak. They didn't realize they were up against, the best America at that time, 1st Marine Division. And toward the end of the campaign, they developed great respect for them.
You tell us that more than any other Pacific campaign, Guadalcanal was a laboratory for testing strategy, tactics, and decision-making over a period of months. Can we finish with just a quick word about this sort of laboratory? In what way did the Americans have to develop new ways of waging war on Guadalcanal?
We learned how to integrate air, land, and sea in attacking an opponent on an island. We learned how to, on land, how to flank and how to feint, how to move around behind the enemy, and then hit them from two directions at once, and how to call in air support. This was something fairly new at that time. And often destroyers would assist in this, on shore, or spotter planes flying over an area would target an area for the destroyers. Another thing that was first used on Guadalcanal was the flamethrower. It had never been used before. And during the latter stages of the battle, the Marines, the 2nd Marine Division, used them for the first time to get at Japanese hold up in caves. Another thing they did was something called time-on-target artillery. Before that, we would shell and shell and shell an area. But usually, after the first round of shelling, everyone took cover. But with time-on-target, all of the artillery would zero in on one area, they would fire at exactly the same time. and just catch the enemy by surprise, and then they would stop. It would just there'd be a lapse, and they would let the enemy come out in the open and hit them again. So there were things that we did. We learned about the enemy. They stupidly attacked the same objectives over and over, over the bodies of their own men. They could not change their tactics in the middle of a battle. And that's where the Americans had that advantage, that tactical flexibility, which the Japanese viewed as a weakness.
You also do tell us that there were certain American officers who, in a sense, failed the test of their first combat in the Second World War, and that if I remember correctly, there was something of kind of a weeding out process on Guadalcanal, where the best officers rose in the ranks, and those that were really not capable of functioning and leading their men well had to be discarded. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, that was particularly in the AmeriCal division that was something that happened often. And that was because the AmeriCal, they were National Guard units. There were three regiments, and one was from North Dakota, one from Illinois, one from Massachusetts. So they were weekend warriors, and they were well-intentioned people. They'd never been in combat, or really a lot of them rigorously trained even. This became, they would send them out as part of an offensive, and part of the regiment would fail. And so they would have to replace the commander. And this became quite often. I forget how many were they processed out of there during the campaign. But the AmeriCal, this was a particular problem. Not so much with the 25th Division. They had an excellent commander, a Lightning Joe Collins. And he did the weeding out when they were training on Hawaii. The 1st Marine Division, they weeded out some too, and they were not loath to do that either.
Hmm. Well, fortunately for the Allies, the ultimate result of Guadalcanal was a victory. And you tell us that the most perceptive of Japan's military leaders understood that this was a crucial turning point, that by no means was the war over. In fact, the war would stretch on years beyond this. And yet somehow, at least in the minds of a few Japanese leaders, this signaled perhaps the beginning of the end. Was it in fact that significant? I mean, was this the beginning of the end for the Japanese?
Yes, it was, definitely, because they had been expanding throughout Asia, throughout the Pacific. You know, Guadalcanal, they were stopped for the first time. They were stopped cold, and they were driven out of Guadalcanal. And from that point on, Japan fought a defensive war. There were no new conquests. They were on the defensive. The Japanese army wasn't as, they were fairly fanatical, their leaders, about they were going to win. They were the samurai spirit and all that, the Bushido. The Navy, they were a little more contemplative about it. In fact, Admiral Yamamoto, who was the commander of the combined fleet, had predicted that if they didn't win the war by mid-1943, the peace terms would be dictated from Washington.
Mm-hmm. That is, of course, where all of this ultimately ended. But in the meantime, this crucial moment in the Second World War is chronicled in such fascinating detail in your book, Midnight in the Pacific, Guadalcanal, the World War II Battle That Turned the Tide of War, published by Da Capo Press. Joseph Whelan, thank you so much for joining me today on the morning show and for talking about your fascinating book. I appreciate this very much.
Really happy to be here.
To finish out today's morning show, you're going to hear a portion of a conversation I recorded with best-selling author Ralph Peters, who specializes in historical fiction, fiction that is very thoroughly rooted in actual history. And the occasion of this particular conversation was the publication of his novel Valley of the Shadow, which sprang from the real-life experiences of the American Civil War in the summer and autumn of 1864, when some of the fiercest battles occurred.
Well, one of the problems with historical fiction is it's got such a bad reputation, because, frankly, too much of it is hysterical fiction, or more fiction than history, and a lot of it is candy-coated, romanticized, even politically correct. And what I'm striving to do is really, we don't have the term, you know, that we have to categorize everything, so it's categorized as historical fiction. To me, it's dramatized history, because I am literally obsessed with getting every detail right, you know, not just the weather that day, but the weather at a given time of day. Was it wheat or rye in that field? What kind of hat did that particular officer wear? And that may seem, you know, a bit mad, but to me, if you get the details all right, the environment of the past, the atmosphere of the past, emerges almost magically. And so while you don't want to burden the reader with details, you have to be selective in their use. You have to know them. And so what I'm trying to do, and it's an ambitious goal, but you have to have ambitious goals in life, I think. My goal is to write the most authentic historical novels possible. So these books, except for Cain at Gettysburg, a few of the enlisted characters were composites. But in this book, The Valley of the Shadow, about the fighting in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864, dramatic, decisive fighting, every character is a historical figure. They're based upon their letters home, letters to them, their diaries, their official reports, their memoirs, as well as some superb research done by modern historians. And I don't want to slight them either. But people ask me, how long did it take you to write Valley of the Shadow? And the answer is over half a century. Because I was grew up in the late 50s and 60s during the centennial of the Civil War. Seems so long ago now. And I was fascinated. I was captivated. And I wrote my first book on the Civil War when I was in seventh grade, almost published by Scribner's. A blessing that it wasn't, because it was pretty bad. But they saw it as a novelty item, you know, Civil War history by this kid. But it's been an interest of mine all my life. I'm not a golfer. This is my vice, as it were. And so it took me a long time to feel confident enough to write these books. You know, I served as an enlisted man, as a career officer, which helped immeasurably in understanding soldiers, of course, and how things really happen. I mean, oftentimes historians will ask, well, why did General X do this? It's obvious. Well, General X might have not have slept for 3 days. He might have had diarrhea or toothache. His soldiers were exhausted. The food hadn't, you know, the rations hadn't been delivered. You learn as a sergeant or a junior officer how hard it is to get a squad of 10 or a dozen men up when they're cold and wet in the middle of the night and get them moving. Well, how much harder is it to get 12,000 men up or 120,000 men and get them moving? So I think my military service taught me how hard things can be. And Clausewitz said that in war, everything is simple, but the simplest things are very, very hard. And that aphorism has a lot of truth in it. So at any rate, what am I trying to do with historical fiction? To make it historically accurate, because I have a secret agenda. And that agenda is to reacquaint Americans with a history we've forgotten. I want to get it as accurately as possible, and I want to move beyond the most famous names, which all we remember now, Lee, Grant, Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart, Sherman, were the big battles, and talk about the incredible drama of this continent-spanning war that really shaped the next 150 years, and is still shaping things today. There are still unresolved issues. So Valley of the Shadow is, I like to think it's an enjoyable read. It's, you know, full of battles and fascinating characters, but it's also good history.
Ralph Peters is the author of Valley of the Shadow, published by Forge Books.